This edition of The Cinema Show was first broadcast on the 1st of January 2016 on Monocle 24. The Cinema Show in association with MUBI.
On today's edition of The Cinema Show, we're looking back at the remarkable life and career of one of film's most indelible and yet strangely underappreciated stars, Barbara Stanwyck.
It's the perfect example as in Double Indemnity. She doesn't care if she isn't liked.
Celebrated by critics today for her natural and extraordinarily modern approach to acting, some of her greatest achievements went largely unnoticed in their time. We'll look beyond the noirish melodrama and Hollywood gossip and get to the heart of what made this legendary icon of the silver screen. That's all to come on The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of cinema on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House in London. And as we just heard, we're focusing today on a woman who pushed boundaries and challenged perceptions during her long career. The Cinema Show, of course, is presented in association with MUBI, and this week, viewers in the US have the chance to see Charlotte Rampling, The Look, which is a wonderfully personal project described as a self-portrait through others. When we look at some of today's most celebrated actresses, whether it is indeed Charlotte Rampling, Helen Mirren, Judi Dench, or of course Meryl Streep, it's easy to forget that the kind of natural and authentic style that we look for in today's screen stars actually took a long time to develop, even going right back to the early days of silent cinema. So I want to wind things back a little this week and look at another actress whose presence dominated just about every film she appeared in during her four decades on the screen. Barbara Stanwyck is often looked upon as the ultimate femme fatale, due largely to her iconic performance as the deathly cold Phyllis Dietrichson in Billy Wilder's quintessential 1944 film noir, Double Indemnity.
Wish you'd tell me what's engraved on that anklet.
Just my name.
As for instance?
Phyllis.
Phyllis, huh? I think I like that.
But you're not sure.
I'd have to drive it around the block a couple of times.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head on your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it.
Now, when we talk about women in film noir, a handful of actresses spring to mind. There's the sharp yet always innocent roles of Lauren Bacall opposite Humphrey Bogart, the sultry beauty of Veronica Lake, whose influence on how strong independent women look is still felt today. And, most dangerous of all, Elizabeth Scott, one of the few actresses capable of portraying a truly irredeemable murderess. Barbara Stanwyck's take on the femme fatale is different, perhaps a little more subtle. In Double Indemnity, her character seduces an insurance man with the aim of using him to kill her husband. But as in just about every film she made, her approach to acting and how she communicates emotions on screen was out of step with her generation, making her somewhat of an outsider among her peers. But it's also a key element in her enduring appeal today. Victoria Wilson is the author of a new biography on Barbara Stanwyck, titled Steel True. The 860-page volume traces the actress's career from its early stages in cinema's silent era up to the cusp of her greatest achievements from 1940 onwards. Victoria joins me now from Monocle's Bureau in New York City. Welcome to The Cinema Show. Now, Victoria, there's so much to cover. Perhaps start us off, though, with a look back at where Stanwyck's time in cinema really began, because I think we tend to associate her with these domineering and formidable screen divas. But that certainly wasn't always the case.
Well, Barbara Stanwyck first came to Hollywood in 1929,
she did make some silent pictures. So silent movie making was coming to an end, and sound was coming in, and it was a big revolution. So she was coming into a Hollywood that had seen the likes of Mary Pickford and people of that sort, who had been huge stars, Gloria Swanson, Mabel Normand, and people like that, who were now on their way out. And Stanwyck came in and made a couple of silent pictures, and then began to rise at the time when Betty Davis and Katharine Hepburn, Norma Shearer, and people of that sort were young actresses and making their way in Hollywood.
It often feels as though the whole world of silent cinema is lost. I mean, even looking at a film like Sunset Boulevard, for instance, released in 1950, even back then you had Billy Wilder in some ways mourning this lost era of beauty and excess. But no matter what decade Stanwyck was working in, she seemed to carry with her this essence of modernity. Is that something we tend to perhaps read into her through the lens of retrospect? Or, well, what's your opinion on that?
Well, in looking at those silent pictures, she made three pictures with Frank Capra, and as an example. And the first she made with Capra was a silent. It was then, at that time, remade into a sound picture called Ladies of Leisure. And when you look at that picture, you can see, even though it is of the time and she does look of the time, the acting is very modern. And the reason why it's modern is because it's natural. It's not mannered. If you look at Betty Davis, as wonderful as she is always mannered, always over the top. And her acting, in fact, which I say in the book, was modeled after another actress, another great actress who was really a stage actress, named Ruth Chatterton. If you look at Katharine Hepburn, as gorgeous as she is and as stylized, and in many movies as powerful, she's still very mannered. And Stanwyck, who in her own time was not considered to be a great actress, or she was considered to be a great actress, but she wasn't celebrated, is always modern because she is natural. And that goes back to a lot of her training from the theater, when she was in a play produced and directed by Arthur Hopkins, which I write about in the book. The book isn't really just about Barbara Stanwyck. It's really a huge cultural history that really covers the first half of the 20th century and talks about what was happening in New York in the theater when Stanwyck was there, and then in Hollywood, and how Hollywood changed.
So as you state in the book, her talent, while very real, was also greatly shaped by the many extraordinary talents that she worked with during her career. George Stevens, John Ford, King Vidor, Cecil B. DeMille, or even Lewis Milestone, just to name a few. And yet, despite her starring roles, despite her enormous box office success and all the popularity that came with that, there was still something between her and achieving that prestigious level of respect. Why do you think that is?
Two answers to that. The first is, as an example, when she was nominated for an Academy Award for Stella Dallas, Moss Hart, who was a good friend of hers, said, "You will never win an Academy Award." And she asked why. And he said, "Because you make it look too easy." And that's part of what her naturalism was. The second reason, I think, is that, you know, Stanwyck, who was in many ways an orphan, her parents died, her mother died when she was four, and her father went off and left her with her three sisters and her brother, who was 2 years older and obviously couldn't take care of her. So she really was sort of on her own in a kind of horrible way, and of course made her way, and that was perfect training to be in Hollywood. And Stanwyck, unlike most other actors and actresses at the time, was never under contract to one studio at one time. And she was never really built up by one studio, unlike a Betty Davis, who was at Warner Brothers, or a Joan Crawford, who was at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, or a Katharine Hepburn, who was at RKO. I mean, the studios had an investment and built up these actors and actresses over a long period of time, and then put them forth in these huge campaigns for the Academy Awards. Stanwyck was always under contract to two, if not three, studios, because she was always felt outside, and she didn't want to be enslaved by the constraints of one studio, unlike her second husband, Robert Taylor, who was a sort of all-American boy who came from a very happy family and upbringing, and who stayed at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer under contract longer than any other actor or actress.
She was nominated for the Best Actress Oscar 4 times during her career, and yet only received recognition from the Academy at the end of her career in 1982 in the form of an honorary Oscar. Perhaps more proof that Oscar success does not equal longevity or, of course, a lasting legacy either. What do you think it is about Barbara Stanwyck that has allowed her work to instill itself so well in cinema history?
She gets to the truth. There's an honesty about her work and an intelligence that comes through and that seems real. And it's just not mannered. It doesn't age. In fact, it only sort of gets more modern because we, the culture, are catching up to her. In the same way, as an example, if you think about Greta Garbo's face in 1927 was an absolutely shocking thing because it was so ahead of the time aesthetically in terms of what people looked like. People at that point looked like Lillian Gish. They looked like Mary Pickford. That sort of modern angular face that Garbo had didn't really come into being until another 35 or 40 years.
Victoria, one of the most striking aspects of her acting for me is this ability that she has to portray both fragility and dominance, seemingly at the same time. But of course, it was a very different time for women, wasn't it? And we've all heard those stories of young starlets being controlled by nasty studio heads like Louis B. Mayer, to the point where it can both make and eventually break them. How did that aspect of old Hollywood play out in Stanwyck's career?
Well, she did make a lot of her own decisions. You know, I write about this one moment where she's about to make a movie for Warner Brothers. She has another movie that she's under contract for, Columbia. So she's decided out of nowhere, because of she's looking around at what other actresses such as Ann Harding and Constance Bennett are making, and she decides she wants a raise, regardless of what her contract said. And what did she do? She just said, I'm going home and I'm not making this movie, which Frank Capra had prepared for her. I think the name of the movie was Forbidden. And she just said, I'm not working. And she stayed home. And what happened? I mean, she was probably 25 at that point. What happened was Frank Capra went to Warner Brothers and every other studio and basically barred her from working. So at the age of 25, she took on all of those studio heads. Now, we can't even imagine what that is like because, you know, they're so sort of commonly talked about, but the power that they had was enormous. She was a fighter, and she fought for the roles that she wanted, and she fought in her career, and she fought for the scripts, and she portrayed that on the screen. What you see on the screen is who she was. But she also was able to come forth with a sexiness or an intelligence.
A few years ago, I stood on the stage with William Holden as a presenter. I loved him very much and I miss him. He always wished that I would get an Oscar. And so tonight, my golden boy, you got your wish.
That was Barbara Stanwyck receiving her honorary Oscar back in 1982. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, back right after this short break.
With a career spanning 50 years across French, English, and Italian cinema, Charlotte Rampling is one of the few actresses of our time whose work today feels just as relevant and enlightening as ever. But that hasn't stopped fans and contemporaries alike asking the ever-present question, who is Charlotte Rampling?
I'm often labelled as someone mysterious, secretive or distant or difficult to access. This is just something I give off because of what's going on inside me, quite simply.
The look is a personal project that sees the actress presenting a series of reflective conversations with her friends and collaborators. Seamlessly blended with scenes taken from some of her most famous films, this self-portrait through others is a revealing look at one of our most iconic screen stars. Charlotte Rampling, The Look, now showing for subscribers across the US on Mubi.
You're back with The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 with me, Ben Ryland. And I'm joined today by Victoria Wilson in our New York bureau. Victoria is the author of a new biography chronicling the life and career of the great film actress Barbara Stanwyck. Victoria, let's touch upon the topic of film noir again. It often seems as though few actresses working steadily in the 1940s escaped starring at least once as a femme fatale, often with varying degrees of success. Now, some critics pass off much of this genre for treating women as two-dimensional figures of darkness, and perhaps an excuse for men to wallow in their failures. Now, that might be perhaps partially true. But do you think there's also some slightly perverse element of strength to be found in some of those female characters who did use their sexuality and power that can come with it to take advantage of seemingly weak men within that very specific noir context?
Those were the roles that she had. And I mean, those were the roles that among the other scripts that she was given, she chose those roles for various reasons. But what's interesting, this is a good question, Ben, because unlike, let's say, a Joan Crawford or a Norma Shearer, Stanwyck doesn't use sexuality in exactly the same kind of open way that an actress, as an example, Crawford or a Shearer. She's much more subtle about it, and it's much more interesting.
Now, Double Indemnity is obviously the most famous example of that, but another one I think worth mentioning also sees Barbara Stanwyck playing a femme fatale, but with a much stronger melodramatic tone. That film is 1946's The Strange Love of Martha Ivers.
My father used to work here as a mill hand.
So did my father, when he was sober.
Now I own it.
Now you're even.
Now I'm even. I was 21 when I took it over. It had 3,000 workers then. It's got 30,000 now. Ran as far as that gate. Now it goes down to the edge of the river. And I did it all by myself. Without Walter, without his father. All by myself.
Half of this should make quite a score.
Half would make you my partner.
That's what I had in mind.
Here she plays the title character of Martha, who, after inheriting a factory empire from her mean old aunt, spins into quite a panic when the reappearance of an old childhood friend threatens to expose a dark old secret. Victoria, that crossover period between the 1930s and the 1940s really saw a new kind of woman take over the silver screen. We saw more and more of what I would argue are quite complex characters, often lead characters, with motivations worthy of some serious critical analysis. Now, this film came just 2 years after Double Indemnity, and there are so many theories on this, but what do you think was pushing this social and cultural shift?
You know, as Joe Heller said, something happened, and that was the war. And the war changed everything, and Double Indemnity, and particularly Martha Ivers, is the perfect example of post-war movie making, because it's all about, you know, it's all about rotten people. I mean, that's what she says. We're rotten to the core. And Iverstown is rotten to the core. The aunt is rotten to the core. I mean, these are just rotten, nasty, horrible people. And for Robert Rawson, who wrote it, it's really the experience of what happened, surviving, and what life was like after the war.
The Strange Love of Martha Ivers was a major box office success in its time, though oddly it's fallen into the public domain. That makes it easily accessible online, which is a good thing, though I'd argue it's a worthy candidate for restoration. Victoria, I want to ask you about Stanwyck's co-star here, because there's quite an interesting story behind it all. This was Elizabeth Scott's second feature film. Now, she's not a widely recognised name anymore. And there are some fascinating reasons for that, which we'll explore in an upcoming edition of The Cinema Show. I was actually lucky enough to meet Elizabeth Scott some years ago while I was in Hollywood, and I recalled an episode that she recounted during an interview with Carol Langer in 1998, involving it was a seemingly small incident that occurred during the making of the film.
And you know, Barbara Stanwyck was in that film too, and we only had one scene together. And you know, we just said, hello, and that was it. She never talked to me again, I never talked to her again. We had that one scene together. It was all very strange. Many years later, I was at Chasen's. She was sitting in another booth. I walked in and sat in a booth next to her. She jumped out of her booth, grabbed me, put her arms around me and said, "Oh, Liz, it's so good to see you." After all those years, I was slightly taken aback because, you know, I didn't have the opportunity on that film to know her or get to know her.
That's part of a very rare interview that Elizabeth Scott gave decades after her retirement. You can watch the whole thing over on YouTube. Victoria, there's a detail there that Elizabeth Scott leaves out, though. When Martha Ivers hit theatres, Barbara Stanwyck was an established star, while Scott was still very much an emerging presence. And yet all-powerful producer Hal Wallace, fresh from the enormous success of Casablanca, insisted that she be given star billing. Now, that bothered Stanwyck enough for her to write a letter expressing her displeasure, something that was politely ignored. And yet, as we just heard, relations between her and Elizabeth Scott remained friendly. Now, that to me suggests someone who was perhaps protective over her career and status, but not to the point of it making her a so-called diva. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
When Elizabeth Scott told that story, she left something out. First of all, she was a completely unknown actress. Barbara Stanwyck was a huge star. And she was in that movie, and she had a very small role. What happened was that Hal Wallace, who had fallen in love with her and had put her under contract to him, was kept making her role larger and larger and larger. And there were all of these scenes between Scott and Van Heflin that really didn't have to be there. Well, of course, Stanwyck was furious, and I don't blame her for being furious. And then Wallace, who was trying to build her. I mean, I've seen the advertising, and the advertising is insane. There was no reason for that woman to have had that kind of attention other than the fact that Wallace wanted it because he was in love with her and he had invested a huge amount of money in her. I can understand Stanwyck's writing that letter. And, you know, it's interesting that she was so gracious. She could cut people dead. You know, when I interviewed people, I would start the interview and I would say, all right, my only assignment is that when you talk about Barbara Stanwyck, you may not use the word professional. You have to tell me what that means. Because they would all say the same thing. How wonderful she was, how cooperative, how brilliant, how she helped everybody, how she helped the director, how everybody worked up to her level.
Now, there is one more film I want to discuss on today's show, and that is the role that scored her the first of four Oscar nominations. That's coming up next on The Cinema Show. Stay tuned.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, your culture guide to the world of film. Victoria, before we spoke today, I asked you, of all the films Barbara Stanwyck made, which one film would you suggest I watch before our interview? And your pick was 1937's Stella Dallas.
Oh, geez, Del, she looks more like you every time.
You remember Uncle Ed, don't you, darling?
Well, I remember you.
Ed.
Huh?
Oh,
how's that?
Oh, Ed, you shouldn't have done it. Oh, don't she look like a little queen?
Oh, in gold and turquoise.
Oh, Edna, you want a drink, don't you?
Sure. And if you don't mind, I'll peel this coat.
Oh, sure, go ahead. What'll it be?
Well, you know me, Stella, I ain't partic. So long as it don't jump up and bite me. But I've been drinking bourbon.
Uh-huh. What have you been drinking?
Oh, nothing. But I'll take bourbon.
Although I'm already quite a fan of her work, I've never quite seen Stanwyck inhabit a role like she does here. I mean, you can hear the difference even just in her voice in that clip.
Well, I write a huge chapter about Stella Dallas because I basically write how it sort of came to be what we now see it as, because it had a long progression. The novel that Olive Higgins Prouty wrote in 1923 was really a book that was written not about mother sacrifice and mother love. It was written, actually, it was much more interesting and daring than that. It was written from the point of view of a young girl who's dealing with divorced parents in 1923, which was unbelievably shocking and not done. And then it was turned into a play, and it was written as a play for Mrs. Leslie Carter, who was at that point 70 years old and in desperate straits. And it was made exactly in a way that Olive Higgins Prouty didn't want, which was totally melodramatically. And it just, they sort of kept ratcheting it up and ratcheting it up for Mrs. Carter. And that's the mold, that is the Stella Dallas that we see today, which really, as I say, is not connected to the novel. And then what happened was that Goldwyn made a silent picture with a woman named Belle Bennett, who was a fabulous actress, and it was an extraordinary hit. And she was everybody was wonderful in that movie. I've seen it many times. And so when King Vidor decided to, or Goldwyn decided to remake the movie, they basically did it shot for shot. You know, of course, they're different. Belle Bennett is very different from Stanwyck. But Stanwyck saw that the way to play that role was as two different women, which is how she plays it. In one moment, she's very sort of subtle and herself and real. And in another moment, she's blousy and dressed to the nines and, you know, sort of looking, as they say, like a Christmas tree lit up. But when it comes to the love between the mother and the daughter, that is when she's real and honest. And it was a huge role for her.
This is one of those films that quite masterfully leaves you with the feeling that you've just been on a journey with the character. We start off with Stella living at home with some quite awful parents. She manipulates a situation that allows her to pursue a relationship with a wealthy man. They marry, they have a child, but the difficulties really emerge when she finds it almost impossible to assimilate with those more accustomed to the company of those from a so-called higher social status. What we see in this film, I think, is the sadness that really engulfs Stella as she slowly discovers who she really is and how disappointed that makes her feel. And she becomes almost obsessive about ensuring that her daughter isn't brought up amidst a similar conflict. It's quite an emotional experience.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, that's why the movie is so powerful. And what's interesting, I hope, Ben, if you have a chance to see it on the large screen, you do, because when I wrote about that movie, I had only seen it on a small screen. And of course, you know, for the past 2 years, I've been talking about and showing movies and traveling around the country. And at a certain point, I had a chance. I was introducing a showing of Stella Dallas. And I said to everyone, of course, you will be in tears thinking, not really, because I have so many problems with the inconsistencies in her character, in the way it's written. But anyway, I saw it on the screen, and it is magnificent. It is a magnificent performance when you're looking at it on a large screen.
Stella, I can't have our child living this way.
What's wrong this time?
It's not just this time. It's every time
What do you mean? Because there was a couple of drinks? Well, what's wrong with that? Coming in here with that icebergy way of yours.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be rude. But she's my child, too, and I won't have this. I haven't wanted to take Laurel away from you, but if you...
Take her away from me? What are you talking about? How dare you say such a thing? Give it to me.
Now, Stella.
Give it to me,
Stella,
I say.
Stella, please, you mustn't do this now.
Give it
Stella.
To me. Watch out, you're hurting
Stella.
Her. Get out.
A tremendous film indeed. That was, of course, Stella Dallas from 1937. Which brings us to the end of this week's show. Thanks to my guest today, Victoria Wilson, author of the new Barbara Stanwyck biography titled Steel True, published by Simon & Schuster. The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. Listen again to this show and find out more at monocle.com or subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, or if you have an Android phone, try the Pocket Cast app. And you can always get in touch by sending me an email to br@monocle.com. I'm Ben Ryland. I'll be back next week. Until then, thanks for listening.